Alright, we're beginning here with the new perek on Daf Yud Chet Amud Aleph. The Mishnah begins, Kohen Gadol, the regards of the Kohen Gadol, Dan, V'danin Oto. He can sit as a member of a Sanhedrin, and he also can be adjudicated or he can be tried by a court. Me'id, he has the right to testify, U'me'idim Oto, and we can testify against him. Choleitz, he has to do Chalitza with a woman who would have fallen to him because his brother passed away without having children. V'chotzim li'ishto. And similarly, if he passes away, then his brother, had the Kohen Gadol not had children with this woman, would also have chalitza with the wife of the Kohen Gadol. U'mi'abim et ishto. And again, if the Kohen Gadol passes away without children and leaves a wife behind, that wife can have yibum with one of his brothers. Avahu enu mi'abim. On the other hand, he cannot perform Yibum, b'neishu asur ba'almana, because a Kohen Gadol, unlike a Kohen Hedyot, has additional restrictions. The Kohen Hedyot is restricted from marrying a Grusha, a Zona, or a Chalutza, but the Kohen Gadol, in addition to that, is also restricted from marrying an Almana, or any woman who is not a Bitula. So, of course, if his woman was already married to his brother, she is now an Almana, and she's also, in all likelihood, not a Betula. So there's no way that he can perform Yibum with her because she is a woman who is restricted to him. And we know the rules with regards to Yibum, with that when you have a woman that is restricted, then we don't perform Yibum. Depending on the level of the restriction, if it's a Chiyub Karet or a Chiyub Mitat Beitin, then the Yibum would fall away by itself, meaning there would be no mitzvah Yibum. In cases where there is an Iser Aseh or an Iser Lav, then we require you to do Chalitza, and not Yibum. Right, so now, mate lo mate, if he has one of the relatives that is Chayav Dita Belehem that passes away, Enu Yotzei Achar Amita, he does not go after the bed. The bed here refers to the equivalent of what today we would call the coffin. In their day, they took out the individual on the bed. In all likelihood, it might have even been the bed that the person passed away on. And they carried them on this bed to their gravesite. So normally, the individuals or the avelim would accompany the bed, would accompany the coffin on its way to the graveside. But here, we don't want the Kohen Gadol to get too proximate to the mate, because we're afraid of him becoming tamei. And we know there's a restriction against the Kohen Gadol becoming tamei. Again, unlike a Kohen Hedyot, who does become tamei for his seven relatives, that is Chayav Lita Bel Alehem, not only is he become tamei, he is commanded to become Tamei. The Rambam writes about a Kohen that does not want to become Tamei for one of the seven relatives that he's Chayev to Itabel Alehem, that person is an Achzari. That's someone who is cruel and indifferent. That's someone who lacks the proper perspective and emotions to deal with these situations, and we actually force him to become Tamei. On the other hand, the Kohen Gadol is restricted from coming Tamei, even to the seven relatives. So over here, we have to prevent the Kohen Gadol from coming Tamei, and how do we do that? We say that he can't get close or proximate to the coffin, to the mitah. He enters, and they disappear. They appear, and he disappears. What's being described here, according to Rashi, is that as they go through the city, they move through the different roads of the city. As they move into a road, he does not visible to that road. So if they turn a corner, they're no longer visible to him. And then he appears on the road that was behind them. Then as they move through that road and then disappear around the corner, then he appears in the next road. And that's how they move through the city. He would keep a certain amount of buffer or distance between himself and the mitah, so much so that they would not be visible to him. He wouldn't actually see the mitah. Every time they turned a corner, that's when he would be allowed to proceed and go forward. But Yotzim him ad petach shara here, he's allowed to follow them out to the gate of the city. At which point, the lack of buffer, meaning that there are no longer any streets, doesn't allow him to continue with the procession because we can't create that type of buffer anymore, and therefore he has to let the procession go on to the graveside while he returns to the Mikdash. Divrei Rabbi Meir. That is Rabbi Meir's position. Rabbi Yehuda Meir, Eino Yotzei Min HaMikdash. He doesn't even leave the Beit HaMikdash, Shem Shenemar, U'min HaMikdash Lo Yotzei. Because the Kohen Gadol, the instruction to the Kohen Gadol, is that he not leave the Mikdash at all. So now, the Gemara later on will discuss, what about Rabbi Meir? Doesn't Rabbi Meir have to deal with the fact that the Torah says, Umin HaMikdash Lo Yetzei? seems from the Pashtut of the Pasuk, that's literally what it means, that he may not leave the Mikdash. And therefore, Rabbi Yehuda's position is really understandable, Rabbi Meir's position is not understandable. Rashi over here already brings us some preview of what the Gemara is going to say, which is that instead of saying min ha-mikdash lo yetzei, it means min ha-kadosh or kedusha lo yetzei. Min ha-mikdash doesn't mean literally the mikdash, but it means figuratively the mikdash. From the kedusha, from his kedusha, he may not leave. What would cause him to leave his kedusha? That is tuma. So he may not become tamei. How do we do that? We create a preventative buffer between him and the mitah so that he doesn't become tamei. And that's Rabbi Meir's interpretation of min ha-mikdash lo yetzei. He may not leave his status of kedusha, but not that he may not leave the mikdash literally. The Gemara actually will go on to say that the machlok between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda is actually how much of a buffer do we need to create between the Kohen Gadol and the coffin in order to make sure that he has not become tamei. And even Rabbi Yehuda, in that case, would believe that min ha-mikdash lo yetzei does not literally mean min ha-mikdash, but rather also means that the Kohen may not leave his kedusha, but he thinks that it's too risky to allow the Kohen Gadol to go out into the roads, into the streets, and follow the mitah, because there could be some confusion that happens, there could be some pushing, there could be he was overcome with emotions, or he's so distraught, despondent about the mate that he rushes towards the mitah, and we don't want that, we don't want any risk involved in that. If you read it that way, it seems to indicate that the Isser that we're speaking about here, min ha-mikdash lo yetzei, is actually a din derabonon and not a din deoraito. And it's exactly what the Ran says or concludes based on the Gemara's discussion later on, that the discussion or the machloket here in the Mishnah revolves around this din derabonon about how much buffer, how much protection we need to give to the Kohen. And the Ramban takes up a similar position. And he says that the pasuk of min ha-mikdash lo yetzei is just coming to bolster the other requirement of the Kohen Gadol, which is that a Kohen Gadol onein still is makriv korbanot. And so what does it mean min ha-mikdash lo yetzei? It means that he won't leave the mikdash because he's still engaged in avodah, or he's still allowed to be engaged in avodah. And so for that reason, he min ha-mikdash lo yetzei, because he continues to work in the mikdash, he continues to do things as normal. So now, based on all of those opinions, you would say that it's a din derabonan. And the Rambam himself quotes it in the Sefer HaMitzvot, and seems to indicate that this is one of the mitzvot of a Kohen Gadol, that he min ha-mikdash lo yetzei. And so he sees it as being a din deoraita, not a din derabonan. And then you would have to chalk that up to something that is considered to be our harchoka mi deoraita. We find that Rambam Paskin similarly with regards to Erva, Lo Tikrivu the Galot Erva, which we'll bump into in a number of Dapim here. The Rambam sees that restriction as being a restriction to Oraita and not a restriction to Rabbanan. And you have to say something similar over here, that the Gemara's discussion later on, which is speaking about how much of a buffer do we set up between the Kohen Gadol and the Tumah, as being in a restriction to Oraita to prevent the Kohen from becoming Tameh. So here you have a machloket as to whether his din is a din derabonon and a din deoraita. Again, from the psukim, it sounds much like the Rambam, that it's a din deoraita, min ha-mikdash lo yetzei. From our Gemara's discussion about the machloket here between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda, it makes it sound like it's a din derabonon. So now, ukushu menachem, machemim, when he goes to comfort the individual who has lost a relative, and they have the ma'amad, where the individuals who are accompanying the mourner give consolation to the mourner, then derech kol ha'am ovrim b'zeh achar zeh, that the people, or the am, walks one after another, they pass in front of the mourner. V'hamimuna mimetz'o beinod ben ha'am. And the way that the Kohen Gadol does this nechama, or pays his consolation, is that the mimuna, the individual who is the chief of staff of the Kohen Gadol, the Skan Kohen Gadol, is on his right. The Am, the remainder of the people who are paying their consolation visit, are on his left. Mimatzo, he squeezes him, he puts him in the middle between the two. I think the idea of being over here, once again, creating a buffer, we don't want him coming necessarily into direct contact with the mourner, who in all likelihood is Tamei Mate. And so what we do is we put the Am in between him and the mourner, as well as we have the Skan Kohen on the other side, for the kavod of the Kohen Gadol. And so then he walks with a buffer between himself and the mourner in order to give that consolation or that nechama. When he receives nechama from others, kol ha'amorim lo, all the people say to him, anu kaparatcha, we are your kapara. We will bring forgiveness to you. We will accept whatever punishments or difficulties that are befalling you. We accept them upon ourselves and we take them away from you. This is very similar to the language that we find. We spoke about this in the Gemara in Kiddushin and in other places where when a person's parent passes away, in the first year after the parent passes away, the proper thing to say after you say the name of that parent is Hareini Kaparat Mishkavo. I am an atonement for his death. In essence, you are accepting whatever difficulties or atonement they need, you accept it upon yourself so that you can raise their level in Olam Haba or bring them a certain amount of Yeshua in Olam Haba. So that is true on the personal level for an individual with a parent. Here it's true on the national level with regards to Kohen Gadol. Since the Kohen Gadol in some senses isn't even able to mourn or to be like a regular Onein or mourner because of his position and his requirement to stay in service in the Mikdash. So therefore the Am comes and says that we are Kaparatcha. We are going to be your Kapara. We are going to take upon ourselves the burden that you would have borne had you been a regular individual and you weren't in the service of the Am. And he responds to them that you should be blessed from the heaven, that he's giving them a bracha in return for the goodness that they're doing on his behalf, or basically the personal obligation that they are taking on behalf of him. He says to them that you should receive a bracha for that burden that you are carrying. And when they feed him the first meal after an avel comes back from burying the mate, the first meal, Mishnah tells us, and the Gemara tells us that he may not eat from his own food. That has to be provided by the community or by the close relatives of the mourner. And so, kishmavrinoto, when they put out that first meal that is prepared for the mourner, kol ha'am misubim al aretz, the entire nation, or anybody who's there to be a part of this meal, misubim al aretz, they are on the ground. They eat or they're reclining on the ground. And he does it up on the bench. Or in essence, what he's indicating is, they are the avilim, and he is not the avel, because again, the Kohen Gadol is not entitled to take that personal avilut for himself, so he has to go back into service for the Am. So in his stead, the Am are, in essence, acting like the avilim, or the avilim, in this sense, to take that burden off of him. And that's why he sits up on a safsal, they sit in the karka, to indicate that difference between what is the normal situation in which the avel is on the ground, and the mourners are sitting either with him on the ground or on the chair surrounding him. Over here, you have it the other way around. The Avel, who's the Kohen Gadol, is on the chair, and the people who are coming to accompany him or to be with him, they're on the ground to indicate this difference in the nature of the Avelut of a Kohen Gadol. So just in general, in terms of a paradigm, we know that in Parshat Shmini, after the death of Aaron's children, we have such a circumstance in which the Kohen Gadol, who is in the service of the Am, is now faced with a personal tragedy, a personal avelut, and Hashem tells him, you're not allowed to leave the Mishkan. You're not allowed to desist from your service in the Mikdash. You must continue as if nothing happened. And so for Aaron as the Kohen Gadol, that's very difficult emotionally. We know that Aaron takes a big step when Moshe tells him about this, and Vayidom Aaron, he's silent and accepts the decree of Hashem. But in some senses, it's a very difficult charge to the Kohen Gadol to, in essence, to forego his emotions in order to be in service of the Am. He's not really belonging to himself. He doesn't have a personal life anymore or personal emotions because he's in the service of Klal Yisrael as a whole. As the Pasuk says in Perek Yod, Pasuk Vav in Parshat Shmini, Vayomer Moshe l'Aaron ul'Elazar itamar banav, v'shechem al tifrau. Bigdechem lo tifromu velo tamutu v'al kol ha'ida itzof v'acheichem kol beit Yisrael itku et ha'sreifa asher saraf Hashem. That Bnei Yisrael will be the ones who do the avelut on your behalf, the ones who cry on your behalf, because you are in service of the people and you can't leave your post. So Bnei Yisrael will fill in for you or take your place in the avelut over here. Now, in the Parsha of Shmini, there is some back and forth between Aaron and Moshe, which seems to indicate that Aaron believes that there has to be some personal expression, there has to be some venue or outlet for his personal emotions, and that might explain some of the disagreement between Moshe and Aaron there about what to do about certain korbanot that were burnt or were not supposed to be burnt, but that might be demonstrating Aaron's necessity to have an emotional outlet, and to say there has to be something that changes. It can't be as if nothing happened. I understand I'm in the service of the Am, but there has to be some sort of acknowledgement of the personal tragedy that I am undergoing. And you see here a similar idea with the practices of the Kohen Gadol, that even though he remains in service of the Am and he remains in the Mikdash, we still have small indications of the people's understanding of his emotional state and his necessity for that expression. And so they try to help him with that expression in sitting on the karka, in saying that we are kaparatcha, we will take everything that's ra'oi for you, we will take upon ourselves. So there is this national recognition that we have to do more because the Kohen Gadol, who is our representative in the Mikdash, can't do it for himself, that we have to step in that breach and fill in for what he can't do for himself. Now, the second part of the Mishnah is a contrast to the first half of the Mishnah, which is the first part of the Mishnah talks about the Kohen Gadol, second half of the Mishnah is talking about the Melech. And you can understand, these are primary figures of authority in Bnei Yisrael. You have the Kohen Gadol in the religious realm, and you have the Melech in the political realm. So we just explained about the Kohen Gadol, now we explain about the Melech, and that's how this parak continues from the previous parak, because at the end of the previous parak we discussed about bringing cases of the Gadol and the Kohen Gadol, and our Gemara, this Mishnah and our Gemara will continue along that theme, which is dealing with persons of such stature, how do we deal with them in cases of adjudication. So a melech lo dan, he's not allowed to be part of a beit din, but lo danin oto, and he's not allowed to be put on trial. Lo me'id, he cannot testify in a trial, velo me'idim oto, and one can't testify against the king. Lo choletz, he does not perform chalitza, velo choltzim li'ishto, and we don't perform chalitza with his wife. Now there, we have the problem that the ceremony of chalitza involves a certain amount of degradation of the individual who's performing the chalitza. Over there we discuss about the way that the Torah describes it literally is the spitting in the face of the person who's performing chalitza. The Gemara will say that it's not that he has to spit in the face literally, but we spit in front of them rope that can be seen by the Beit Din. But there's a certain amount of a degradation or humiliation about this person who doesn't want to perform Yibum is performing chalitza, and that would be inappropriate for the king. As we'll see, that melech shemachala kvodo, kvodo ina machul. The king does not have a right to forgive his stature, his position of authority, and that's because it doesn't come from him. It doesn't belong to him. He's serving as the national leader. He's serving in a position, and he has to, in that position, make it a position of authority and a position of stature, and so he can't forgive or he can't waive any rights of the melucha, because of the nature of the melucha and the standing of the melucha, which is an institution that's greater than him. And so therefore he doesn't have a right to engage in these activities, in some senses, because it's beneath his dignity. Lo choltzim li'ishto would be the same thing, which is that the king and the wives of the king, we'll see in a second, are on a different plane. They are designated for the king, and they cannot be taken by anybody else besides the king. Lo mi'abim, he doesn't perform yibum, v'lo mi'abim et ishto. And again here, it's the same idea that the king is in his own league, and that he doesn't get involved with these type of, called mundane matters, or issues that involve other people's wives, or his wife. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, im ratza lachlotz, o liyabeim, zachor letov. Rabbi says, what's the big deal? If he wants to perform the mitzvot haTorah, then why can't he undertake to perform the mitzvot haTorah? If he wants to do it, and he does it voluntarily, then zachor letov, all the better. He should be remembered for good. Now, we may not compel him to do it, but if he voluntarily does it, why would we stop him? Amarlo, ein shomim lo. Chachamim, the Tanakhama says we don't listen to him because of what we discussed until now, which is he is part of a greater institution and he can't make the personal choice to degrade the institution of the kingship. Ve'nosim amunato, one is not allowed to marry the widow of the king. Yehuda Omer, Nosea Melech, Amunoto Shel Melech. Another king is allowed to marry the widow of a previous king. Shekein Matzino Bit David, Shenasa Amunoto Shel Shaul. We see that David married the widows of Shaul, Shneamar, Benalachat Beit Adonecha, Beit Sheadonecha Bechekecha. As Natan and Avi tells David when he's chastising him over the chet of Bathsheba, he says, why do you need all of this? Why do you go so far? And in chastising him, he says that I already gave you the house of your master, meaning I gave you the melucha in place of Shaul, and I gave you all the wives of Shaul. So he's reading it literally, wives of Shaul being the amanot of Shaul. On the other hand, the Tanakhama is going to have to read it that the neshe adonecha, I mean the women that are appropriate for you, from the house of Shaul, which are Merav and Michal bat Shaul, but not necessarily the widows of Shaul. So you see here that they felt it was appropriate that David would marry the widows of Shaul. So Rabbi Yehuda says, as you're right, for a lay person to marry the widows of the king would be inappropriate, but for another king to marry the widows of the king is okay because they're on the same level, or it's at least on par with the previous king. Right now the Gemara says, Kohen Gadol Dan. The Kohen Gadol is allowed to be a member of a Sanhedrin. Gemara says, Pshita. Now, it's not clear why the Gemara thinks it's Pshita, because in a second, the Gemara is also going to suggest that maybe it's not true, or maybe the Kohen Gadol should not be Dan. But, at least up front here, the Gemara thinks that it's a given that the Kohen Gadol can be a member of the Sanhedrin. Now, part of that might have to do with the way that the Kohen Gadol, or the Kohanim and Levim, are described in Sefer Dvarim, which they are the adjudicators, they are the shofet yamim haheim, and that there is this conflation of the shofet and the Kohen Gadol in Sefer Dvarim, and that might have to do with the fact that the Torah believes that the Kohen Gadol is going to be a part of the Beit Din or part of the adjudication process, and therefore the Gemara sees it as being simple and straightforward that the Kohen Gadol is done, that he can be a part and parcel of the Sanhedrin, and it might be especially true late in Bayit Sheni, when the Chashmonaim are ruling, and the Kohanim wield huge power in the Mikdash, that it might have been possible that the Sanhedrin HaGdolah was comprised of many Kohanim, and maybe even the leader of the Sanhedrin was the Kohen Gadol, or was a Kohen. And that might have been the structure of the Beit Din HaGadol. There's some discussion by the Baal Yeh Tosafot with regards to Mufla Beit Din, which is the individual is considered to be the highest authority in the Beit Din, whether he was actually a member of the Beit Din, or was that a separate position that was independent of the members of the Beit Din. But it might be that the Kohen Gadol was that Mufla Shebe Beit Din when it came to the Sanhedrin HaGdolah. So there is a tight correlation between the Sanhedrin and the Kohen HaGadol. Therefore, the Gemara feels that Kohen Gadol Dan is Pshita. You don't need a Mishnah to tell you that. Danin oto itzrichales. The Gemara says, no, you need the other part, which is you're allowed to bring him to trial. Anami Pshita. The Gemara says, that's also straightforward. Ilo danin lei iu hecha dayan. If we are unable to bring him to trial, then how is he able to be a judge? Vahakti. Don't we have a pasuk that says, hitkoshishu vekoshu? So the pasuk in Sfanya is quoted by Reish Lakish, and Reish Lakish interprets the pasuk in the following manner. It's not the Pashtut of pasuk. We've spoken about it when we learned this in Baba Batra, which has a fuller explanation of this about the Pashtut of pasuk and how it parlays into this limud. But right now, it will suffice that the koshishu vikoshu means that if you want to do something actively, you must first reflexively do it to yourself, which is Amar Reish Lakish kshot atzmecha. That first one must check themselves before they go and check others. One must make sure that their house is clean before they go to clean other people's houses. Or, if you're going to rebuke someone, make sure that you rebuke yourself first. And so, too, over here, that if the Kohen Gadol can't stand trial, how can it be a judge? A judge can only be a judge if he himself could be someone who could be brought to trial. Because in that way, there's this balance that he can be brought to trial over crimes or misdeeds that he does, and therefore that grants him, in some senses, the right to be a judge, because he's subject to the same rules and laws as he is trying to enforce or adjudicate. So if that's the case, it would have been obvious if the Kohen Gadol is allowed to judge, that means that obviously he's allowed to be judged. So again, now we have no chiddush in the Mishnah. Ella, How did the kabayin the mitnei melech? Since the Mishnah wants to speak about a king, lo dan velo danin oto, that there it's the opposite, where he's not allowed to adjudicate, he's not allowed to be a member of the Sanhedrin, and we do not bring him to trial. So tananami kohen gadol dan v'danin. Therefore it brings the kohen gadol in contrast where it's dan v'danin, but ein achanami, there's no chiddush on the side of the kohen gadol. V'baitema hakamash malan. Others say that this is what the Mishnah is going to teach us. Kedetanya, Kohen Gadol sharagata nefesh b'mezid. Kohen Gadol, who kills intentionally, premeditatively, neherag. He is a murderer, and he will be subject to a death penalty. He'll be killed. Bishogeg, if he does it unintentionally, goleh. Then he goes into galut, like any other person that would have killed Bishogeg. Ve'over l'asei v'alot asei. And if he violates an asei and a lot asei, he has the standing of a layperson for all of his matters. So now the Gemara says, "Bizmezid neirag." The fact that if he is a premeditated, intentional murderer, that he is subject to a death penalty, is put to death. Kshita. Why would you have thought otherwise? Anybody who murders is subject to the law, and if the law says that a murderer is put to death, the Kohen Gadol is not free of that law. So the Gemara says, "No, b'shogeg goleh itzrichaleh." The fact that by Shugeg, where it's unintentional that he goes into Galut, that you needed to teach me. Hanami Pshita, that's also pretty straightforward or obvious. Because, why should he be any different than anyone else? Gemara says, no, Itzrich. Over here, it might be different. Sakadat chamino obyektiv, v'yeshev bad motakoen agadol, that the punishment of being put into Galut lasts until the death of the Kohen Gadol. Eima, kodi leitakanta bechazara ligle. Anybody who has the ability to be freed at some point from the punishment of galut, that individual then is subject to the possibility of being put into galut. On the other hand, if the individual can never be released from galut, maybe he never has to go into galut. So then, that's what the Gemara is suggesting. That might have been your Havamina. And so therefore, since over here, the late lady Takanta Bechazara, this Kohen Gadol, who has no way of escaping the punishment of Galut, lo ligle, then maybe he shouldn't be put into Galut. It's not, because we have a Mishnah that tells us with regards to a Horeg Kohen Gadol, a murderer who murders the Kohen Gadol, o Kohen Gadol sharaget nefesh, or a Kohen Gadol who murders, enu yotzei misham le'olam. They are eternally, permanently stuck in the Ir Miklat, because, as the Baal Tosfot point out, there is no Kohen Gadol. You can only be freed by the death of the Kohen Gadol if the Kohen Gadol is there when you're put into Galut. So in under normal circumstances, whenever you are sentenced to Galut, at that time, wherever the Kohen Gadol is, will be your meter to determine how long you're there. When that Kohen Gadol passes away, then you'll be free. If you predecease the Kohen Gadol, then you're not going to leave the Ir Miklat. On the other hand, if the person murdered the Kohen Gadol, there is no Kohen Gadol. Or, if the Kohen Gadol murders, he's the one on trial. He can't be the one who frees himself by his own death, because his own death would then also terminate his life and wouldn't be subject to Gola anymore. Now, as the Baal Tosafot qualify this, the Gemara in Horiot explains to us that it's only true if Nigmar Dino, if the sentence was pronounced before there was a new Kohen Gadol that was appointed. On the other hand, if it happens after a new Kohen Gadol is appointed, then that new Kohen Gadol will be the basis for the freeing of the Kohen Gadol or the murder of the Kohen Gadol from the Ir Miklat, from being put into Gola. So that's the only qualification over here which says that in situations or circumstances where the Gemar Din takes place after there's a new Kohen Gadol installed, then you won't be there permanently. Or the possibility that there is a Kohen Mishuach Milchama that is there, or a Kohen that is a Mishuach She'avar, which the Gemara tells us all those qualify as equivalent to a Kohen Gadol. If they pass away, they do free whoever is in the Arei Miklat. So in all of those instances, if the person kills, murders the Kohen Gadol, the Kohen Gadol murders, then there is a Kohen Gadol that would release them from the Arei Miklat. So our case must be speaking about a situation when you don't have any of those options. There's no Mishuach Milchama, there's no Mishuach She'avar, there is no Kohen Gadol that has now been appointed. But absent that, then someone who murders the Kohen Gadol or the Kohen Gadol murders are going to be in Gola forever. So the Gemara's Havamina is, Emalo Ligle, maybe they shouldn't go into Galut. Since they can never get out, maybe they shouldn't have to enter. Kamashmalan, that's not true. That even if you can't get out, doesn't prevent you, doesn't lock you out of going into Galut. And that's the Yechidish of the Braita, teaching you that the Kohen Gadol, Bishogei, goes into Gola. Gemara says, Ve'malchanami. Wait, why do you say Kamashmalan, that's not true? Maybe it is true. How do you know that it's not true? If the Kohen Gadol can't be freed, that he still goes in. Amar Kra, that's because the Pasuk says, Anushama Kol Rotzeach. Says that any murderer must run there. Afilo Kohen Gadol b'mashma. Kol Rotzeach means any murderer. It doesn't give an exclusion, doesn't give any release for any murderer. It means anybody who murdered unintentionally and subject to Gola has to go into Galut Erei Miklat, irrespective of their ability to escape that punishment or to have that punishment end at any point in time. So then the Braita said, Over al asei va lo tasei. He violates an asei and a lo tasei. So the Braita makes it sound like that the Kohen Gadol will violate an asei and a lo tasei. And to that the Gemara asks, Lo sagi de lo avar. Is it a truism that he must violate an asei and a lo tasei? The Braita writes as if it's a foregone conclusion. That he is Over al asei va lo tasei. That he will violate a positive commandment and a negative precept. Why is that? Mar says, no, hachi kamar. Ima varla se valo tase doesn't mean that he must or he will, but rather if he did. If he violated a positive commandment or he violates a negative precept, harihu ke hejot tuchot varab. It's either or here. If he violates an asay or a lotase, he's treated like a hejot. The truth is that only for a lotase are you really brought to Beit Din, and with regards to mitzvah tase, there is no real punishment in Beit Din, although we do have midrabanan makat mardut, which is the lashes of rebellion for someone who does not follow through or does not keep mitzvot tasei. So that might be what the Gemara is referencing to over here, that the Kohen is subject to the normal procedures of a layperson when it comes to the violation of a regular asei or a regular lo tasei. Mar says, Pshita, why would you have thought otherwise? Why, he's not exempt from the law, and why would you have thought that he can't be tried like anybody else? It says, "Sakadat chamin hol butznan ein danin lo et shevet v'lo et navi sheker v'lo et kohen gadol al pi beit din shel shivim ve'echad." I would have thought that when it comes to the adjudication of a navi sheker or a whole shevet or the kohen gadol, we would require the beit din gadol in Yerushalayim, the Sanhedrin gadolah of shivim ve'echad of 71. So you see in this list of individuals from our first mishnah in the parak that require a Beit Din of 71. The Kohen Gadol is one of those individuals. The Amar of Adar Ba'ava, what was the source for the fact that the Kohen Gadol has to appear before 71? Because it says, Kol HaDavar HaGadol Yaviu Eilecha. Anything that is too big, they will bring to you. Dvarav Shel Gadol. That means the cases or the situations of the Gadol. It's not describing the difficulty, the enormity of the case. It's describing a case that relates to someone of stature or someone who is a big public figure. And that means that it's the Kohen Gadol. When you deal with the Dvarav Shel Gadol, you deal with the issues of the Kohen Gadol, then we'll bring it to Moshe. And Moshe Rabbeinu, as Rashi notes over here, was in place of the Sanhedrin HaGdolah. And so there, if that would be brought before Moshe in that case, then Latid Bavo, that means that it's going to be brought before the Sanhedrin HaGdolah. So Gemara says, Ema, you would have thought, Kol Dvarav Shel Gadol, that any matter or any issue of the Kohen Gadol must be brought before the Beit Din of Shivim Echad. Kamash Malan, the conclusion is, no, we don't say that. Gemara says, Ema Hachanami, why not? Why don't we say that any issue that relates to the Kohen Gadol have to be brought before the Beit Din of Shivim Echad to the Sanhedrin Gadolah? It says, Miktiv Divrei Gadol. It doesn't say all matters of the Gadol. It says, Hadavar HaGadol, the Hei Idea. Those matters that are really big, Tiv, Davor Gadol Mamash, means a really big issue. Or in essence, what we're saying is that the Pashtut of Pasuk still exists, which is the Pashtut of Pasuk is called Davar Gadol. Gadol means complex. That means issues that are serious in nature or that are capital crimes. Those are Gadol. So what we're saying is that the Davar Gadol of the Gadol must be brought before Moshe or before Beit Din of Shivim Echad. And so, therefore, only the Dvar Gadol has to be brought before Beit Din of Shivim Echad. But other more mundane assays and lot assays, that he'll be tried in a regular court or in a regular Beit Din. He does not require a Beit Din of Shivim Echad. because that's not a big issue. Right. Now the Gemara says, Me'id or Me'idin Oto. So when it comes to the Kohen Gadol, we're allowed to testify against him, and he's allowed to testify against others. Me'id, is he really allowed to testify? B'hatanya. Don't we have a braita when it comes to a Shabbat of Eitam, which says, V'ita lamta. So the pasuk over there says that one must return the lost object to their friend, and you may not turn away, you may not look askance and pretend that you don't see it and ignore the item. You have an obligation to engage and to deal with the item and not to walk away from it. But now the Gemara says, V'italamta, pamim shaitan mitalim. V'italamta comes to teach you. Again, it's out of the context of the pasuk. That's not what the simple reading of the pasuk would mean. But the Gemara takes that and isolates the word and says, V'italamta, to tell you that sometimes things are mitalim, disappear. And there are other times where you don't hide. So there's sometimes where you hide, sometimes when you don't hide. Ha keitzat. When do you hide and when you don't hide from returning an aveda? Kohen v'hu b'beit hakvarot. If he's a kohen and the aveda is inside the cemetery, and he would have to enter into the cemetery which has tumat mate in it in order to retrieve the aveda, he can walk away. Zakein v'ena l'fik fodo. Person is a person of stature, a person of age, and it's beneath his dignity to pick up the aveda. He wouldn't pick it up for himself. It was his aveda. He's not going to pick it up for anyone else, and therefore he's exempt from the mitzvah of Hashavat Aveda. It's beneath his dignity. Or the foregone profits that you would have to work on this aveda to return the aveda exceed the value of the aveda or exceed the returns that you would earn, then in that case, you don't have an obligation to return the item and to sustain a loss for yourself. It's only in a case where your salary, your schar batalah, would equate to your salary, and therefore you would not sustain any losses, or you weren't working anyway. In those instances, then we obligate you to engage with the aveda, because you won't sustain any losses. Kach ne'mar v'italamta, and that's why the pasuk says v'italamta, that you should look away, or you look away in some instances. But obviously there are cases where you're not allowed to look away, and that's what the Torah restricts. You can't walk away. You can't ignore the aveda and pretend as if you don't see it. But what you see from here is that in instances like here, where the Kohen Gadol is a Zakein Vein Lefi Kodo, or it's in the Beit HaKvarot, he is granted the exemption of Eid Alamta, that he's allowed to look away, he's allowed to walk away from it. So also over here, isn't it beneath the dignity of the Kohen Gadol, beneath his position to testify in court, because he'd be coming into a regular court case for some lay person, and to have or to subpoena the Kohen Gadol to come in and testify is something that would be beneath his dignity. If that's the case, then Beit Alamta, he should be able to walk away, he should be able to not engage in the issue. So now we want to know, where is it that the Kohen Gadol is testifying? If it's beneath his dignity to testify, that means there'll never be a situation in which he testifies. So the Baalei Tosafot over here say, why don't we answer that it's Eidut HaChodesh? When it comes to the sighting of the new moon, why can't we say that's what the Kohen Gadol is coming to testify about? Because that obviously would not be beneath his dignity. And of course we would accept testimony from a Kohen Gadol who saw the new moon. So the Baalei Tosafot here draw a distinction, which is an important distinction, which is a difference between Isura and Memona. And that is that when it comes to Midah the Isura, it comes to issues that are a violation of an Isur, Ein Chochma ve'ein Tmuna ve'neged Hashem. We don't make any calculations. We don't try to twist and turn around it. We deal with it right on, head on. And therefore, there's no exemptions that are granted. And the fact that we say, there's a refrain that the Gemara brings, Dochin lo taseh b'chob shimba Torah b'shvil kvod ha-birot, or Dochin aseh b'shvil kvod ha-briot, that for a person's dignity or for kvod ha-briot, we allow an individual to violate an aseh or a lo taseh. The Tosafot says it's only hanimile memona. That's only true by monetary matters. Aval mimide de isura lo. But when it comes to matters of isur, that is not the case. And so what the Baalei Tosafot is suggesting over here is that we couldn't have given the answer about Kiddush HaChodesh, because anything that deals with isur and heter, anything that deals with performance of mitzvot, that's not a monetary matter. Over there, the Kohen Gadol gets no exemption. He is then compelled to testify in the matter, because we don't grant them the exemption of kavod when it comes to isurim. Also, the other answer that the Bayit Tosafot say is that the Mishnah parallels between the Kohen Gadol and the king. So where is the instance where the king is Einu Me'id Ve'en Me'id Lo, where he can't testify and we can't testify against him? The Bayit Tosafot point out that's only in monetary matters for the same reason he said before, which is that by Isura, Ein Chochma Ve'en Tzvuna LeNeged Hashem. We don't take anything into consideration when it comes to Isur. We want to have it cease and desist. We want to get involved and intervene immediately. And so that means that you can't, that even by a melech, you'd be able to testify against the king, or a king could testify about Isura. So by the king, where we say, Eino me'id ve'ein me'idin lo, that must be speaking about a situation of mamon. So just like by the king it's a situation of mamon, so too by the Kohen Gadol it's a situation of mamon. And that means that Kiddush HaChodesh wouldn't be an option, because that is Isura. So now we have Amar Rav Yosef, Me'id LaMelech. There is one person that sits a little higher than the Kohen Gadol, and that's the king. So there would not be beneath his dignity to come to testify about the king, or testify for the king. And so there we found now an instance where the Kohen Gadol would be required to, Kohen Gadol would be required to testify, because it's something that's within the realm of his dignity. Mar says, wait a minute, why would he be coming to testify for the king? Vatnan, didn't we just see in our Mishnah, Lo Dan, V'lo Danin Oto. He does not judge as a member of the Sanhedrin. They do not judge him. Lo Me'id, V'lo Me'idin Oto. He does not testify. V'lo Me'idin Do, and then they don't testify against him. So if that's the case, then the king is never in a court case. If the king's never in a court case, then why would it be that the Kohen Gadol needs to testify for the king? Alright, so then the Gemara says, Amar Rav Zeira, Me'id L'Ben Melech. No, he's not testifying for the king. He's testifying for the prince, the son of the king. Where it says, Ben Melech, Hejotu. The son of the king, a prince, is a regular layperson. He has no standing, he has no stature. The king has that, but his children do not have that. Therefore, why would it be in the dignity or within the scope of the position of the Kohen Gadol to go testify for the Ben Melech, who's just a Hejot? Ela Me'id Bifnei HaMelech. Now, it's not that he's just going to testify for the prince, but it's going to be in front or in the presence of the king. The king is going to sit in the court in order to facilitate the ability of the Kohen Gadol to come and testify. Because if the king is there within the bounds of his position or his dignity to come and testify in court, so even though the Kohen Gadol is coming to testify about the prince, the presence of the king makes it okay or appropriate for him to come and testify in the case. It says, V'ayim u'shivim melech b'Sanhedrin. Don't we have a principle that a king is not allowed to sit in the Sanhedrin? So now, the Gemara's question is a little strange, because we just quoted from the Mishnah, and you could have quoted the same thing over here, which is, V'ha-melech lo dan v'lo danin oto. When it comes to the king, he does not, a member of a Sanhedrin, he can't be judged by a Sanhedrin. If that's the case, then why doesn't the Gemara bring that as the question? Here the Gemara brings the question, V'ha-ein moshevim melech b'Sanhedrin. We don't put the king in a Sanhedrin. Why don't you just quote our mission that says, V'lo dan, v'lo danin oto. So the Bayit Tosafot say over here, V'teima, lifroch min nitan tetzad melech lo dan. Why don't you just quote it from our Mishnah? V'yesh lomar. So here the Tosafot brings a qualification to our Mishnah, which is, the ha dan melech dan, the fact that a king is not allowed to adjudicate case or sit as a judge, hana mila levado. That's only when he's alone. Mishum de'ein danin oto. Since he can't be judged, it would be inappropriate for him to be a judge, based on Reish Lakish's principle, which is kshot atzmecha v'achakak kshot achirim. Since the king cannot be brought to trial, he doesn't have a right to be a judge in that case. But that's only true when he's alone on the case. Whereas if he's a member of a larger group or a larger Sanhedrin, then it sounds from here that the king can be a member of the Sanhedrin, because over there, the Lokrinim Beit Koshushu Bekoshu. Because there, the conclusion of the case will not be brought by him alone, but rather him together with the other members of the court. And so thereby, Tosafot qualifies this idea that the king is not allowed to adjudicate or be a part of a Sanhedrin. That's only true when he's doing it alone. But if he has other members, other judges along with him, then according to the Bayit Tosafot, that'd be totally fine. That's why the Gemara had to go to a different source, which is Ba'imim Shavim Melech B'Sanhedrin. Instead of quoting our Mishnah, he says our Mishnah is not relevant to that. Our Mishnah is speaking about a Kohen Gadol alone. But if a Kohen Gadol is together with others, you would have been able to do it. And that's the case over here. So then we have to come up with the other reasoning, which is in Shavim Melech B'Sanhedrin. So the Gemara answers Mishum Yakra the Kohen Gadol, because of the honor of the Kohen Gadol. Ato v'yotif. The king comes and sits in the case. Mikabli ni'ale l'sadute. They then listen or accept the testimony of the Kohen Gadol. Kaihu v'azil. He gets up and leaves. And then the judges go on to investigate or look into the case. The melech shows up just to provide a proper venue for the Kohen Gadol to come and testify. He will not be a member of the Sanhedrin. He will be just sitting on the side of the Sanhedrin. And since he'll be sitting on the side, it's not problematic because he's not a member of the Sanhedrin. He's not sitting with the Sanhedrin. But it'll also still allow the Kohen Gadol to come and testify because it will give the circumstance and the context enough dignity for the Kohen Gadol to come and not say that it below his dignity. What's interesting over here is that is the reinterpretation of Rav Yosef's statement. We had our Mishnah that suggested the Kohen Gadol does testify. Rav Yosef's answer about what the case is, that it's a case where he's testifying for the king. We might ask questions on that, and then we reinterpreted or readjusted Rav Yosef's statement to make it that we're speaking about a prince in the presence of the king. The question is that what Rav Yosef meant? Or is it possible that Rav Yosef really meant that he testifies for the king? That the Baal Tosafot take up over here. The Baal Tosafot ask, isn't there a distinction that is made between Malchei Beit David or Malchei Beit Yehuda versus Malchei Yisrael? And that is the restriction in our Mishnah for a king that ain't done, vein danin oto, is only relevant by a Melech Yisrael, by Malchut Yisrael. By Malchut Beit David or Malchut Beit Yehuda, over there the Mishnah does not apply, and we do try the king, and we do allow the king to be a judge. The Dalia Tosfot asks, wouldn't that have been the simplest answer over here? Simplest answer over here is to say that our Mishnah that says Me'id is speaking about a king from Yehuda. The Mishnah says Lo Dan Lo Dani No To. It's talking about Malchei Yisrael, and the case of Me'id or Me'id in Lo of the Kohen Gadol is talking about a case of Malchei Yehuda. So the truth is that that is the position or the distinction that Rav Yosef makes later on in our Gemara. And that might have been the intent of Rav Yosef over here when he says Me'id the Melech, that he could testify for the king, that he could testify for a king from Malchut Beit David or Malchei Beit Yehuda. But the truth is that the Gemara continues as if that's not the case. The Baal Tosafot say that because that would ruin the parallel structure of the Mishnah. Then the Mishnah would have a case where it's dealing with two different types of Malchim, where the king can't be judged and can't be a judge. That's talking about Malchut Yisrael. The case where the Kohen Gadol is Me'id or Me'id in Lo is talking about a case where we're talking about Malchei Beit Yehuda. And that would be inconsistent. What Tosafot says is that the Mishnah needs to be consistent, that they're all Malchei Yisrael or all Malchei Yehuda, or the fact that the Mishnah makes no such distinction would lead us to believe that there isn't such a distinction in the Mishnah. And so based on that, we got to assume that our Mishnah is talking about Malchut Beit Yisrael. And even though it's Malchut Beit Yisrael, the Mishnah still says that the Kohen is Me'id. So what's that situation or circumstance? It can't be the Melech, because the Melech is not tried at all. Ela, it must be for the prince in the presence of the Melech. Gemara says, Gufa, Ein Moshevim Melech B'Sanhedrin. We don't put a king in the Sanhedrin. Below Melech B'Kohen Gadol B'Ibur Shana. And the Melech and the Kohen Gadol cannot be participants in the Beitin that is deciding about Ibur Shana. The Melech B'Sanhedrin, how do we know that the Melech can't be a member of the Sanhedrin? Dichtiv, Lo Taneh Al-Riv. Says, you may not pervert a Lo Taneh Al-Rav. We read that to mean that one may not respond to the Rav, to the greatest one that's there, or the person who's in the position of power. And therefore, if the king speaks, one is not allowed to contradict the king. So if you can't contradict the king, then how can you ever have a case where the king's there? So now, the way that a Beit Din works is, when it comes to capital cases, that we start from the smallest member of the Sanhedrin, and then we move to the most prominent member of the Sanhedrin. The reason for that is because of that hierarchy, which is that the highest member or ranking member of the Sanhedrin, nobody's allowed to contradict him. So if he spoke first, the case would be closed. So therefore we start from the youngest or the lowest individual on the totem pole, and then we move all the way up to the Muflash of the Beit Din or the leading member of the Beit Din, and he states his opinion last. And that way you don't have this problem of contradicting the Rav, the greatest one at Beit Din. So the truth is that that solution could work over here as well. Yeah, if the king is a judge or a member of the Sanhedrin, then simply have him be the last one to speak. So what the Baal Tosafot point out over here is that it would be inappropriate to have the king wait to last to speak. Now you can't ask the king just that. You sit there quietly. We'll call on you later. So when it comes to the Beit Din, that's the protocol of Beit Din, and that's the way it works in the hierarchy of Beit Din. But if the king comes in to say to the king, listen, you can't talk. You have to listen to everybody else speak. and then in the end you could speak. So that would not be appropriate or for the dignity or the position of the king, and therefore we don't allow him to be a member of the Sanhedrin or the Beit Din, because it would be problematic if he spoke first, because nobody could contradict him, but it would also be problematic the other way around, which is that if he waited to last, it would also be beneath his dignity to have to wait for everyone else to speak. The king and the Kohen Gadol may not be participants in Ibur HaShanah. Now, we already stated that they can't be members of Beit Din. It's very hard to understand what it means over here that they can't be a part of the Ibur HaShanah, which is a Beit Din that requires 3, 5, 7, depending on what we saw in the Mishnah. So what you'd have to suggest is that the individuals are a part of that process of deciding about the leap year don't all have to be judges or don't have to be all members of the Sanhedrin. There might have to be a certain number of members of the Sanhedrin, but then they can invite other experts to come or other wise men to come. So maybe they invited the king or they invited the Kohen Gadol to be one of those 7 members who's deciding about the leap year, the intercalating of the calendar. Melech Mishom Afsanyo. The reason that the king can't be a party to that is because he has to pay his troops. So Rashi claims that the king will always want a leap year, because the king pays a yearly salary to his troops, irrespective of the number of months in the year. So the king will always benefit if you put in a leap year, because then at a cost of 13 months, he'll get for 12 months, he'll get a year's salary, and he'll get a 13 months of work out of his chayalim, out of his soldiers. So Rashi says that the king will always be predisposed to making it into a leap year. On the other hand, if you look on the side here, the Masoreh Shas quotes the Aruch, who says just the opposite, that the king pays the salary of his soldiers on a monthly basis. So if you make it into a leap year, he's going to have to pay out of pocket, because the king collects sufficient taxes to pay the soldiers that are in his army. But that's sufficient taxes if it's a year. But if it comes out that the year is actually 13 months, he's going to have to fork out of pocket for that 13th month, because that wasn't considered in the taxes that they collected to pay for the chayalim in this year. In that case, the Aruch would believe that the Kohen is always predisposed to it not being a leap year, because if it's a leap year, he's going to have to pay an extra month out of pocket. Kohen Gadol, the reason the Kohen Gadol can't be part of that decision process is Mishum Tzina, because of the cold. Rashi claims it has to do with the Kohen Gadol's avodah on Yom HaKippurim, which he has to start with going to the mikveh, and he goes to the mikveh 5 times and washes his hands and legs 10 times. So he's going to have to get into the water, and he's going to freeze if it's late in the season. So if you make it into a leap year, it's going to push Yom Kippur back, and it's going to put Yom Kippur into a colder period of time. So the Kohen Gadol is not going to want that. Again, he'll be predisposed to making it earlier rather than later, because it'll be warmer for him. And so therefore he's biased about it. The Baalei Tosafot say it's a little strange that that's the explanation of Rashi about the cold water in the mikveh, because we know that the Gemara discusses in Yoma the fact that they used to throw hot iron rods into the mikveh in order to warm the water for the Kohen Gadol. And over there, there's a very large Tosafot that discusses the issue of Psikreshe and Psikreshe Delonechale. But over there, the Gemara states that they used to throw these hot iron rods into the mikveh to keep it warm for the Kohen Gadol. So it can't be that that's what he's worried about, is the cold water that's going on in the mikveh, because it wasn't a cold water mikveh. It was a warm water, even a hot water mikveh that was kept heated up for him. So the Baalei Tosafot, on the other hand, suggests that the cold that we're speaking about here is the fact that the Kohen Gadol Yom Kippurim, and actually all year round, has to walk barefoot in the Mikdash. So in the time period where the Kohen Gadol is very active, like in Yom Kippurim, and he has to walk barefoot in the Mikdash, he'd rather be warmer than colder out, so that his feet don't get cold from the stone that he's walking on all day. And so therefore, again, the Kohen Gadol would have a predisposition to it not being a leap year, because then it would keep the weather warmer. Either because of what the Baalei Tosafot say is to keep the floor of the Mikdash warmer, or for Rashi, it'll keep the mikveh warmer, and it'll be easier on the Kohen and the Avodat Yom HaKippurim. Amar Papa, Shmamina, Shata Barta Yarcha Azil. You see from here that the year goes after the seasons. The way the Rashi explains it over here is that if you make it into a leap year, then the seasons remain static, and then you just move the year back a month. Which means that if what is now would have been Cheshvan, because you made it into a leap year, we're a month behind. So what would have been Cheshvan without a leap year is now in the year with the leap year, Tishrei. And so what you're suggesting now is that Tishrei in that year takes on the character traits of Cheshvan. And Cheshvan is usually colder, and the rain and the cold have already come in. So when you postpone it a month by putting in a leap year, what you're suggesting over here is that what otherwise would have been in Cheshvan will now even be in Tishrei. And that's why the Kohen Gadol would reject it or not want it to be a leap year, is because that would put Tishrei in where Cheshvan would have been. And then that's pretty cold, because you're moving it back in the year. You're making the Jewish calendar fall out later in the seasons. That's what Rashi says the nature of the Gemara's question is. The Bayit Tosfot say, I really don't understand the question. The question makes no sense, because isn't that the whole point of making a leap year? The whole point of a leap year is to intercalate the lunar calendar to line it up with the solar calendar. So the only reason you would be putting in an extra month into the lunar calendar is because the seasons are shifted. And what you're trying to do is normalize it and bring Tishrei back into the right season where it's supposed to be. So how could that be what the Gemara is asking here? That, oh, the leap year makes it that the months of the year correlate a month later with what otherwise would have been the weather that month later. Well, the whole reason that you're putting in a leap year is because the calendar until now was falling back, and all you're doing is resetting Tishrei to the autumnal equinox when it otherwise would have been in the Tkufa of Tishrei. And so in the end, the Balei Tosafot suggests over here, what the Gemara is asking over here is, in essence, if we are going to adjust the calendar for future items that will be out of place or not come in time, for instance, if we see further on the year that the Perot Ha'ilan, the fruits, are not going to ripen in time, or that Pesach will not be in the Aviv, then we are already going to put in a leap year beforehand to push it back. So now we are making the decision based on factors that are in the spring. That will have implications on the fall as well. Because in that sense, you're pushing back Tishrei because you're trying to solve a problem about Nisan. And in that case, you actually will move Tishrei further back in the season. And so we know that actually that is true, because over a 19-year cycle, the average of all the lunar Tishreis will actually fall out on the solar Tishrei. And so that means that sometimes the lunar Tishrei will be before the solar Tishrei, and sometimes the lunar Tishrei will be after the solar Tishrei. Sometimes the lunar Tishrei will be long before the solar Tishrei, and sometimes the lunar Tishrei will be long after the solar Tishrei. Because on average, they're going to equal the solar Tishrei. But since we're doing it through the adjustments of the leap year, that causes it some years to be later, some years to be earlier. And so therefore, the nature of the Gemara's question is then, when we're making those adjustments, not always because of Tishrei, because of other factors, it's going to shift Tishrei around and push Tishrei sometimes further back in the season, whereby Tishrei will take on the normal seasonal effects that you would expect in Cheshvan, which is how in the colloquial we speak about the Yomim Tovim today, people will say, oh, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur are early this year. Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur are late this year. What does that mean? Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur always come on time. They're always on the 1st of Tishrei and on the 10th of Tishrei. They're always on time. When we say that it's earlier and late, we're looking at relative to the solar calendar. And we're saying, well, this year, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur are coming out late in the solar calendar or early in the solar calendar. Yes, they're coming on time in the lunar calendar, but relative to the solar calendar, that which is the static point, which is the solar calendar, the lunar calendar is shifting back and forth between late and early. And that's what the nature of the Gemara's question is over here. And the Gemara says about that, Ini, is that really true? Ba'anach gimo roke bakar. Weren't there these three cowboys? Davu kaime. They were talking. Bisham inu rabbonan tgamre. And the rabbonan who were trying to deal with intercalating the calendar overheard them saying the following. Chadamar, one of them said, Imbachir vilakish kechada deyenatz. If it is that the early planting and the late crops are emerging at the same time, that means that the early crops that were planted like the barley and the late crops that were planted like the chitim are emerging. Obviously the barley is coming out earlier than the chitim, but if they come out in that month, they emerge out of the ground simultaneously. Dein hu adar. Then you know that that is adar. Vim lav. If that's not the case, late then Adar, then this isn't the month of Adar, it is Shvat. Meaning that if it's the case that only a small amount is emerging, but not everything's emerging, that tells you that you're still in the winter season, that means it's the month of Shvat. If it already has reached the point where everything is emerging from the ground, that's an indication that we're already in Adar. The Chadamar, and one of them said, Im Tor Bitzafar bitalag yamot, that if a shor in the morning it is so cold that he nearly dies from the cold, ubetiara, by the time you reach the afternoon, bitul teina yidmuch, that he will put himself under the shade of the fig tree, yishalach mashchei, and he'll rub himself, his skin, up against the tree, looking to cool himself off. Dein hu adar. Then you know you're in the month of Adar. Meaning that the volatility or the deviation between the cold of the morning and the heat of the afternoon is so great, that it tells you that it's the month of Adar. The month of Adar has very cold nights and mornings, but very, very warm days. If it's not that way, late in Adar, then we're not in the month of Adar. If the easterly wind is blowing strong, easterly wind which brings the cold, that your breath, then when you blow against that easterly wind, it goes out to greet it and warms it up, then you know you're in the month of Adar. Vimlav, if that's not the case, where then you let out a breath against that easterly wind, and the easterly wind washes away your breath and makes everything cold, then late in Adar, then it's not Adar, it's Shabbat. So what the Roed Bakar were doing, we're giving simanim, signs of what are indications of whether it's the month of Adar or the month of Shvat. Or in essence, determining whether it's the season of Shvat or the season of Adar. And it'll be Adar if it shows the seasonal characteristics of Adar. And if it doesn't show those seasonal characteristics, then it's Shvat. But what you see from that is that the months of the year are correlated directly with the seasons. Adar has certain character traits with it, and those will always be true. Leap year or no leap year. Shvat has other traits associated with it, and they will be true whether there is or is no leap year. And therefore, Rabbanan put in a leap year in order to align the Adar with the simanim that were being given by these Roei Bakar. And therefore, the Rabbanan intercalated or made a leap year out of that year. Mar says, V'tizbara, does it really make sense? Rabbanan arivato samuch? The Rabbanan rely on a bunch of roim, shepherds, cowboys, to tell them whether they should make it into a leap year or not? El Rabbanan achush benayu samuch? The Rabbanan did their calculations, and they see whether Pesach and Sukkot are going to fall out in their proper seasons. Then, V'roei bakar istayu ehut istaye miltayu. And then they overheard the Roei Bakar, they overheard these cowboys, and they just reconfirmed what they had already seen in their calculation. Their calculations already indicated that Pesach was going to fall out too early, and that we would say in Tishrei, it would also, Sukkot would fall out too early. And so therefore they felt that it was necessary to put in a leap year. But then they overheard the Roei Bakar, which corroborated what they were seeing in their calculations, that it was too early. That the simanim they normally associated with the dar were not appearing, and therefore it must be Shvat. Well, how can it be Shvat and not a dar? Well, you have to put in a leap year. If you make it a leap year, then the first Adar, in essence, becomes Shvat, and the real Adar, which is Adar Sheni, then will be a month later. And then the simanim that they were expecting would come to fruition. So therefore, what Rashi suggests over here is that, Klomar, Itramidahu Mazal Chashivut Dikla Ibor Kimiltayu. They got lucky, the Roei Bakar, that the Chachamim were going to make it a leap year anyway, and therefore all their simanim came true in that case in the month of Adar. But mehiu berova shvanim, berova iburim, shata batar yarchazla. But in a normal circumstance, it doesn't work out that you align the lunar month with the season or simanim that are associated with that month. But rather, depending if it's a leap year or not, the month would take on the different characteristics of the seasons. So when it's not a leap year, Tishrei would have the properties of Tishrei. If it was a leap year, then Tishrei would have the properties of Cheshvan. So in majority of years, that would be the case. When you put in a leap year, you actually shift the months to be in a different part of the season. Whereas for the Balei Tosafot, who thought the whole problem here was the fact that if you were adjusting for one matter, it might have impact on another matter. Then the question from the Roei Bakar is, you see here that the Roei Bakar mentioned Sina, cold, and they also mentioned Perot Ha'ilan. So here you have two Roei Bakar mentioning both issues, the issue of Perot Ha'ilan and cold, which means that, or it seems to indicate that the two are correlated and not separate. The way that you were asking the question was, if we adjusted for Perot Ha'ilan, that might have impact on the season in terms of cold. So therefore, Tishrei might be cold because we're adjusting for Perot Eilan. But the way that the Roi Babakar was speaking is that the cold and the Perot Eilan were one and the same in terms of their impact from the leap year. And the Gemara's answer is no. The Rabbanan came up with their calculation. It just happened to turn out that the Roi Bakar's statement corroborated for them what they already knew about the year. And therefore, they weren't relying on the Roi Bakar, but rather they were making it to a leap year. And the Roi Bakar got lucky that they happened to align the two issues up. So therefore, we're not going to take literally the statements of the Roi Bakar that Perot Eilan and Sina are always connected. It happens to be this time that they were connected because the Rabbanan already concluded from their cheshbon that that was the case and it was needed from both perspectives. And that may not always be the case where the adjustment for one is also necessary for the other. And because that's not true, then when you adjust for one, it's going to have impact in shifting the season of the other. So therefore, we put in a leap year for the Perot Eilan. It might be that Tishrei is later than in the season and it takes on the properties or the cold of Cheshvan. So now this is the question that you asked on the Mishnah, which is Chaleitz v'Chotzim. It says about the Kohen Gadol that he does perform Chalitza, and we perform Chalitza to his wife. It says, Pasik v'Toni. The Mishnah makes no distinction. It makes a definitive statement without any qualification. Lo shna minei usim, lo mishna minei nisuin. Doesn't matter whether his brother was married to this woman through Erusin, meaning a halachic engagement that was not consummated, whether his brother was married to this woman through Nisuin. The obvious difference between the two of them is whether the woman is a betula or not a betula. So why is it that the Mishnah does not differentiate between those two cases? Because Bishlam, I mean a Nisuin, if the Kohen Gadol's brother was married to this woman and consummated the marriage, then the Kohen Gadol would not perform Yibum with this woman because he has two restrictions against him. He has a mitzvah to say to take a bitula mi'amav, and he has a mitzvah lo to say not to take an almana. So if you have an asay and a lo to say, vein asay docha lo to say vasay. The asay to perform Yibum cannot override the lo to say of taking an almana and the asay of taking a bitula. Ela mina yusin. On the other hand, if his brother passed away after being halachically engaged to this woman but not consummating the marriage, that means that this woman is still a bitula. Amai, why is it that the Kohen Gadol shouldn't perform Yibum here? Yavo asay, the asay of Yibum should come, v'yidche lot asay, and override the lot asay of not marrying an almana. Because the asay to marry a bitula is no longer problematic. She is a bitula. So the only restriction against the Kohen Gadol is not taking an almana, but he has an asay of Yibum. And we generally have a principle of asay, Dochelotasei. So in that case, he should be able to perform Yibum. If it was a case of where his brother passed away, Mina Erusim, and Yibum and Erusim should have been permissible for the Kohen Gadol. Gemara says, no, Gzera B'Yarishona, Atu B'Yashnia. The problem is that there's only a mitzvah in the first Biyah that the Kohen Gadol has with this Yivama. So if he has Biyah with her the first time, yes, he's Mekayim a mitzvah, and therefore he has a Asei that is Dochelotasei. But that's only true in the first Biyah. But by the second Biyah, there is no longer a mitzvah of Yibum. And now he'd be living with her when she is an almana, violating the lav without the commensurate asay to override that lot asay. Gemara says, Tanya Namiyoch, we have a bright that supports that understanding as to why we restrict Yibum for the Kohen Gadol, whether his brother was married Be'erusin or Ben Nisuin to his wife. Which is im kadmu ubalu biyah rishona. If they went ahead and they had the first biyah in terms of the yivama kano, then he is koneher because it is a proper biyah. It's an asay dochalot asay, and it's mekayim the mitzvah of yibum vaasur lekayma biyah shnia. But then he can't remain married to her. He can't keep her to have a second biyah because that second biyah would not be protected by the asay of yibum. Okay, we're gonna stop here by the two dots on the top of yud tet amud aleph.